I think we're fairly new at it. We haven't done it for a long, long time. We were a very small group and in some ways a threatened and in certain senses marginalized group in the United States. The history of the church itself is a fairly colorful one, being driven from the east out into the deserts of the west where it could live safely. And, of course, we're well known for missionary outreach. But as we've grown, we've become aware of the fact that that we're living with neighbors of other faiths. In Utah, for example, it really wasn't largely the case, although we have good relations there with the Catholic Church, for example. But we're very interested in being good neighbors. And one aspect of the church that I think many people don't realize is that it's not only what you might call exclusivist in the sense that it believes it has the truth and sends missionaries out around the world. It's also inclusivist in the sense that from the very beginning, from the 19th century origins of the church, there have been very positive statements made by church leaders about the truth in other religious traditions, including Islam. There are official statements from the church long before it was politically correct or fashionable to say, paying tribute to Muhammad, for example, as having received light from God, and also paying tribute to the reformers and other great religious founders around the world. So we're very comfortable doing interreligious dialogue, very comfortable talking with respect with people from other backgrounds.
Is there this interfaith dialogue going on constantly throughout other faiths as well?
Many faiths are interested in it. Of course, the Catholic and Protestant churches have been involved in ecumenical dialogue for a long, long time. That actually had, at one point at least, the goal of eventually effecting some sort of unity, even in some eyes, a merger between various denominations. That seems not to have gone very far. It didn't actually work. Nobody's merged. So there's much more emphasis now, I think, on simply interfaith understanding, coming to understand where the other person's coming from, because obviously there are substantive differences between faiths, but some of the differences that are out there really don't exist. They're just artifacts of words. As if you can come to an understanding, you may find that you use different language to express something, but your positions may not be as far apart as you thought. And that, I think, is much more in fashion right now, to do that kind of dialogue.
With an academic approach like your church does through the university's program, is this academic approach the best way to look at this interfaith dialogue and encourage this interfaith dialogue?
I don't know that it's necessarily the best way. I think it's one way. One of the ways of encouraging interfaith friendship, it seems to me, is mutual service. For example, my church has partnered with Islamic Relief Services to bring aid to people in Indonesia following the tsunami or to earthquake victims in Pakistan. And in many cases, members of my church have actually worked side by side with Muslims, preparing food shipments, preparing shipments of other goods and relief supplies to those places. And I think much more so even than having academics talk to one another, which obviously as an academic I like very much, but more than that, having people actually work together in a great cause that transcends denominational or religious differences, I think that's probably the most effective way. I'd love to see more of that.
To your reading of Islam now, and how is this ancient faith currently coping in the 21st century world?
I think that that Muslims face very difficult issues right now. There is a vocal minority that claims to speak for Islam, and that often intimidates alternate voices within the Islamic world, that is pushing an extraordinarily rigorous, hostile view of the rest of the world. And that's difficult, particularly as Islam is transcending its origins in the Middle East and even its heartland areas in Indonesia and so on, and is now showing up increasingly in large numbers in the UK, in Australia, in the United States, Canada. One of the issues that that Muslims have to deal with is the question of how is it possible to be a Muslim living in a society that is pluralist? That is multicultural, where the government is not going to enforce Sharia law and never will. Historically, under the classical legal interpretations, it was actually illegal for a Muslim to live outside of a Muslim country. He should, if he found himself in those circumstances, move into a Muslim country. That's obviously not happening now. People are moving out into places like Australia. And so the important thing is to learn how to be a Muslim under these new circumstances. And I think it's a really interesting thing to watch how Muslims are developing new institutions to cope with this, how they will adjust to being simply one faith among many in a city like Melbourne, where they're not going to be the dominant force in any foreseeable future, and yet they want to retain what's essential. So the question is always to decide what is essential to our faith and what is accidental, What are the things that we had always assumed were essential, but actually may not be? You don't have to have them to be a faithful Muslim.
Malaysia is one that says, well, we're a moderate Muslim nation. Yeah. Is this where other faiths would appreciate seeing Islam going in the 21st century?
I'm absolutely sure they would. I think that that the outside world has a great deal resting on how Islam deals with these questions. And we have to look at places like Malaysia and, to a certain extent, Turkey and certain other countries as harbingers of what we hope will come. Places where, but we don't ask them to forsake their Islamic faith, but we do hope that they can be integrated into the world of nations and the community of non-Muslim peoples as well. And some of those countries have been fairly successful at it. It hasn't been flawless by any means, but considering even that the development of democracy in the English-speaking world took centuries, I think it's folly to expect that this is going to happen overnight.
Your church and others may be tackling this interfaith dialogue in this academic way, but is the Islamic faith doing the same thing and asking these questions of itself and of other faiths?
Yeah. There is not as much interfaith dialogue coming out of the Muslim community as I would hope. There is some. I've had very, very good conversations in various places with Muslim leaders, both Arab and non-Arab, about these sorts of issues. And increasingly, they're going to have to as they live in places like Melbourne. So I know there are things going on here in Melbourne where local Muslim leaders and devout members are interacting. And I was in Brisbane earlier in the week, and I saw the same thing there, where they're coming out and talking with Christian clergy, with people of various faiths, including beyond the Abrahamic tradition, Buddhists and Hindus. I've seen it in Singapore, where I was invited to a meeting at the one of the local mosques, and they invited the head of the Interfaith Council there, who happened to be a Hindu. Now, in the old classical days of Islam, Muslims didn't have much to do with Hindus on a positive note. But there it was very friendly, mutually respectful. And so I see, particularly in the diaspora communities, if you will, that this is happening. In the heartland of the Islamic world historically, with Islam in a dominant position, they haven't really felt the need to do that. There were conversations, of course, and Islam's record of tolerance toward Christianity and Judaism is actually relatively good. It's not ideal, but if you compare it to medieval Europe during the same period, it's light years better. But now in pluralistic societies, they're having to come to grips with that. And so I see some hopeful signs, but there still needs to be a lot more.